Okay, you're listening to MotoGP OD, and you're at the Ace Cafe, San Francisco, California.
What kind of racing do you watch here?
We watch everything down here. We've got old British crap, and we've got all the new stuff, especially with MotoGP Liam as our special guest this evening.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today's Friday, August 15th. This is episode 141, and I'm your host, Jules Cisek, sitting in for Bob Hayes, who is out doing a track day this week. Got a good show lined up for you today. Some news from last week of the MotoGP summer break, a chat with Moto Liam, and an interview with Mark Neal, director of Faster. Also, we've been given a few free downloads of Mark's film Faster from iTunes, and I'm going to have a little contest later in the show for that, so keep listening. But first, let's do some MotoGP news. Next year's calendar for MotoGP is being finalized, and the Laguna Seca round is being moved earlier into July to July 4th weekend, which is in America is Independence Day. It's traditionally a day where Americans barbecue, watch parades, and you know, sports on TV. So it's interesting that the GP was going to be held that day. I think it has its pros and cons. I think probably we'll have a bigger audience on the TV, possibly, but I'm worried about attendance at the actual event. We had a lot less people this year. Well, not a lot, but noticeably less people this year at that round than the previous years. So I'm a little bit skeptical about that decision to hold it on a day where people don't normally travel and stay at home and go to parades and stuff. Other news, Nicky Hayden hurt himself during the X Games. He was riding in a supermoto race and took a very hard landing and broke. Actually, he didn't even crash, but he broke a bone in his heel on landing, and he is going to miss the Brno round because of this injury. Apparently, after consultation with some physicians, including Dr. Ting, whose name always crops up when people are getting either American riders or riders who get hurt while they're in America. He's a physician at San Francisco. His name keeps cropping up. Anyway, he, after consulting with him, Nicky decided not to ride a Brno because it would make the injury worse. It's really a shame because I think Nicky Hayden really enjoys this track. He seems very frustrated with having to miss the round. And there's a really interesting speculation kind of piece that David Emmett over at MotoGP Matters posted about rider injuries this year, and the fact that Hayden decided to drop out of this round, comparing that to Lorenzo possibly coming back a little too early after his crash in China, and that maybe causing his crashes further on in the season. It's a very interesting piece. I'll put a link up on the show notes. Be sure to take a look at that. Thank you, David. We've got Loris Caparossi. It's going to be his 276th start, which will tie Alex Barros as the most ever GP starts. That's a lot of races. Looks like Suzuki has let Vermeulen's option at Suzuki, this is the option to renew his contract, it expired. We have not heard anything about Chris re-signing with Suzuki, and we've been speculating on the show about what's going to happen with Suzuki, Loris Caparossi, Vermeulen, and Ben Spies all fighting for those two seats. I think that Ben Spies is almost surely going to go to Suzuki at this point. We're waiting for confirmation of that, but the fact that Chris Vermeulen's contract has expired without a renewal is interesting and could definitely spell the end of Vermeulen's GP career, at least for the time being. It's a great interview with Kevin Schwantz over at Superbike Planet. I'm just going to read a segment from there. This is regarding the Laguna Seca round last month. He says, I think what we saw at Laguna was a little bit of old school. Here's the way Grand Prix racing is supposed to be. I don't care your bike's faster. I don't care your shit's working better. I don't care you've won a whole lot more races than me. I'm going to stuff you in the next turn, and you're going to have to find another way around me. What's it going to do? It's either going to frustrate you enough that you're going to make a mistake and going to run off the track and fall over. Something's going to happen. And he goes on to say, when I heard Stoner complain a little bit about the passes and the this and that, it's like he never took a shot at you unnecessarily. He ran you off the track. You're the one that put yourself in that position, that put yourself in the position outside of him to get bumped into. And you leaned on him as much as anything. I'd have waited. I'd have let him slid across the track. I'd have driven right by him, and he'd probably never have seen me again. But it's good to see that there's a little fire left in some of those guys out there, because you don't see it very often. It's like, hey, here we go. We're going off into this corner. I'm up inside of you. I'm going to let off the brakes and take the spot. I know it's going to make you mad because I'm slowing down a little bit, but it's the only chance I've really got to beat you. And of course, I'm finishing reading there. And then, of course, we've had a lot of news about Casey Stoner and Rossi and all that whole Parc Fermé exchange after Laguna Seca, when Stoner refused to shake Rossi's hand. Some words were passed between them. That actually continued. Stoner was continuing to say that Rossi was dangerous, that he had lost respect for him. But yesterday, GP1 reported that, and this is a translation from Italian, which actually sounds like it went through French and Spanish first. It was pretty hard to make sense of it. But anyway, the sense I got is that they kind of shook hands at the pre-Brno conference, said Stoner kind of apologized for the comments he made in Parc Fermé. He said they were said in the heat of the moment. It was compared to Rossi's comments about Tony Elias back in Turkey, 2007. But frankly, I think that this is just PR, and the gloves are off, and Rossi now knows those complaints that Stoner made about Rossi's riding. That's exactly what Rossi's going to be doing for the rest of the season. He's going to be frustrating Stoner as much as he can. Interesting thing that is going to happen at Brno is that Valentino Rossi and Fiat Yamaha are going to be trying some new bits, some new electronics on the M1 during free practice. Typically, these kinds of tests are done after the race. Obviously, both Rossi and Fiat Yamaha are very concerned about the fact that Brno is a racetrack that Ducati has always done really well at, Stoner's done well at, and needs speed and power, especially up the hill coming back to the front straight. I think Rossi is an interesting dilemma. The whole team is an interesting dilemma because they could either take the sort of safe way out, you could say, by using the current configuration of the bike, not changing anything, and just preventing Stoner from taking too many points in these rounds where Stoner is sure to do really well, like Bruneau. Or take a chance with some new parts and risk a mechanical DNF. The traditional Rossi DNF hasn't actually even happened this year yet. And I shouldn't really say traditional because prior to 2006, Yamaha and Jeremy Burgess have had an incredible record of consistency in terms of the bike just not breaking down, both the Yamaha and the Honda before that. But anyway, the fact that they are testing some bits, actually in a few minutes, as I record this, they're going to be putting the bikes out for FP1, so it'll be interesting to see what the times look like and what actually might be better for Rossi is if there's not that much improvement and he just decides to go with the previous bike configuration. If the bike is faster, then I think he and the team will decide to use that bike in the race, and there's, of course, a bigger chance of something going wrong. So that should be interesting to watch. Some other little tidbits of news. Danny Pedrosa has hinted that Dovizioso is indeed coming to HRC. He made some comments via GP1 interview, another translation via Babelfish, where he says he doesn't have a problem with Andrea Dovizioso coming to HRC. We've heard rumors about this for a while, but this is the first time that a team principal like Pedrosa has actually said anything about it in the press. So I think that we are seeing Hayden leave HRC, possibly going to take over Melandri's seat in Ducati, since we know that Melandri's contract has been canceled for 2009. We don't know if he's going to finish out the year yet, although he is riding at Bruneau. So it looks like Nicky is going to go to Ducati and Dovi's going to go to HRC. So silly season is definitely spinning up big time. And last, there was some ridiculous kind of regulation mongering over at Indianapolis. Apparently the locals near the track tried to get a noise ordinance passed that would prevent motorcyclists from revving engines and, you know, basically making noise at the upcoming GP round over there. But fortunately, that ordinance did not pass. I think that all the organizers realized it would be silly to hold a motorcycle racing event at one of the most famous racing venues in America and then give tickets out to motorcyclists for having noisy machines. Now let's chat with Moto Liam. This is actually recorded last week at the Ace Cafe in San Francisco. It's a little bit echoey because we were using an iPod to record this that was sitting on the table, a little bit background noise, but hey, it's Moto Liam. I hope you enjoy.
Hey everyone in MotoGPOD land, we're here at the Ace Cafe. It's at 14th Street and Mission, and it's the only place I know in San Francisco where you can watch racing from Superbike, World Superbike, British Superbike, AMA stuff, MotoGP stuff, every single night of the week.
And Eurosport.
Yeah, and in the Eurosport version. So if you're tired of seeing races on Speed Vision or dealing with television commercials, this is the place to go. Two screens, usually one's running at all times with either a DVD of a season review or what have you. I now know the place has an Italian spaghetti western starring Giacomo Agostini and Loris Caparossi and all the rest of the greats, plus the little guys like Poggioli and children at the time, Andrea Dovizioso. And
when was that made?
I believe it was made in early 2004. So I'm here with Jules.
Hello. Hi, Michelle.
I'm here with my girlfriend, Michelle. And time to catch up on some racing.
Yeah, well, first, before we get started on the racing, let's talk about your vacation.
Ah.
So you got to decompress a bit?
Yeah, I think after the six races in a row, I was going through some stuff. I mean, obviously, the team is going through some transitions. What with our team manager shifting out, Luis Dantin said goodbye to the team before Sachsenring. So the last two races, we've been working under our with our normal crew, same people we work with, just without him. And a lot of speculation as to what's going to happen for the rest of the season, what's going to happen for next year. And basically, the honest truth is, I don't know what's going to happen for next year, but I know that we've got a job to do for the rest of this season, and everyone's going to keep doing their job, because we're out here to try and do our best and see what we can do, and we'll continue.
So what did you do in California?
As for my vacation, it's been great. It's been more quiet time at home than I think I've spent in years. A little bit of cooking thrown in, and making salads and pasta, and spending time with Michelle. When I haven't spent time with her, I've been busy. Thanks to Ducati North America, I've had the use of a new white Ducati 848 superbike.
Pearl
white. And I only have a few words to say about it at this time. And that's, my God, what an amazing machine. You know, I could probably talk about that bike for the rest of the podcast. Because to me, it's a small, genetically derived version of their MotoGP bike. You know, you can say, oh, CC size is similar, but the way the power band kicks in is really similar. The ergonomics are fairly similar. Wheelbase, rake angle, all of that is really similar. So as far as the street bike goes, it's dialed in. It's an amazing machine. It's more comfortable than the 999 that preceded it. It just seems to do everything well. It's got a wet clutch, which for me, it seems to be easier to engage, disengage. Also, just coming off a stop sign seems to go together smoothly.
How are the brakes?
The brakes are on par with the 999S I spent last summer on. They don't seem to have the same initial bite that the 999 had. I remember the 999, once I started using the brake, the front end would just kind of drop, and then you knew the front brakes were grabbing. It was an instant, immediate stopping power, whereas the 848 is more user-friendly, what they'll call progressive brakes. And they stop just as hard and just as fast. I mean, there were some times where slowing down for sweeping, you know, switchback corners, I get thrown up out of the seat a little bit just because I'm a little rusty. And all of a sudden you go, whoa, I need to stop right now. Slow it down, not stop. You know, obviously you want to back it down from 100 to 50, and you do that quickly enough, and I go bouncing out of the seat and go, okay, next time I go through there, I'll change something.
How often do you get to ride when you're in Europe?
Virtually never. Yeah.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, because I've always wanted to know, did you ever get to ride the GP bike?
No, I've never ridden the GP bike. And as far as all my mechanics, I have mechanics that have worked on the Ducati machine since 2004 that have never ridden the bike. I know one mechanic out of all the people that I'm working with that has ridden the bike about 50 meters.
So what is it like for a mechanic to actually have to work on a bike that they don't necessarily get the feel of?
For me, when I worked on it in 2006 on the GP6, it was initially with a sense of awe, because you feel, you know, the same way, I guess, a person that changes their oil on the weekend in their own car, all of a sudden they're working on a Formula One car. You know, that's the metaphor. All of a sudden you're working on a GP bike and you see it doing things, and you know that no matter how fast you think your reflexes are and how good you are at a video game, there's no way you can handle this bike. You know, I think the point was really driven home to me in Donington in 2006 when Alex Hoffman was subbing for Loris Caparossi, and he was riding the Marlboro bike. So we took one of Spain's talents, Ivan Silva, who races in their national championship, and he's used to throwing around a Kawasaki ZX-10 superbike, and now that bike's a handful. You know, obviously the Kawasaki always seems to have a slightly different chassis than the norm for a Japanese manufacturer, and that bike's just a brutal power plant, and he's quite good at controlling that bike and racing against R1s and everybody else in the Spanish Formula Extreme Championship. So we thought, okay, let's put him on the GP bike, dial in some traction control, and see what he does. And I remember the first few times he went out on the bike, every single corner the bike was wheeling, you know, 2 feet in the air out of every corner in his first session. And I just thought, whoa, you know, here's a kid that's as big as me, at least 160 pounds, 165, all muscle, and he can't stay on the front end enough. You know, wow. He can't keep that bike down.
Wow.
So he had to change his riding style.
How do guys do it then?
Skill and technique.
Wow.
And I'm sure electronic aids come into play for certain people. Smoothness. That really plays a lot of dividends at this point in the game. As does body position. You really can't emphasize enough that out of all the components on the bike, you can have a chassis that chatters, you can have suspension that's not set up right, you can have tires that are sliding around, but the biggest factor is still the rider, because their body is the biggest suspension component that you can put on a bike.
Right.
You know, if you had to say Nicky Hayden is 150 pounds, that's an active suspension component. And people don't realize that. People think, oh, okay, Nicky's strong, athletic. I mean, he's in fantastic shape. I think the point might be driven home when we watch Valentino Rossi at the Laguna Seca Red Bull GP this past year. You see him go into the dirt and then come back on to the tarmac and bounce over the rumble strip. It looked like he banked on the edge of the rumble strip through the dirt when I look at some of the exploded photos I've seen. But it's one thing to be able to grab the bars and tense up and have a fast twitch reaction for your muscles and your body, because everybody seems to think fast reactions means fast twitch muscle and being able to do something, either push here or twist this or, you know, to move your body actively. But in my mind and in my experience, there's a lot of times where you have to let the bike do what it's going to do, because bike naturally wants to flow. It's got two gyroscopic wheels. It's got an engine that's spinning in a certain direction. The bike wants to do what it wants to do. So the fast twitch reaction, I think that's the most valuable at this point, is the relax mechanism.
Oh, interesting.
So, and people that ride the street or ride the twisties or go to the racetrack might be really good at doing this. They might not realize exactly what they're doing. But there comes a time, like say you're transitioning from a full right-hander to a full left-hander, and there's a bump or a dip in between those two corners, what do? You relax your body for a second, let the suspension settle, and then you go. Or let's say you hit a section. I went riding with some buddies through 200-mile round trip through a bunch of different roads here in the Bay Area, and we went up through Mines, the Junction, and Del Puerto Canyon Road, and then we came over to Alice's, did 35, 84, those roads, and there was a point where I lost the front end on this bike and just slipped away from me completely. Handlebars dropped away, it seemed like a foot. You know, that's probably an exaggeration based on the speed I was going, but it was a sharp downhill right-hander, and the front end just went away completely, and my first reaction was, oh shit. But I just consciously relaxed, let go of the bars, basically, because I usually like to ride with almost no pressure on the handlebars if I can help it. I just relaxed, and the front end caught and re-gripped, and I made it out of the corner, looked at the two cars entering the corner, coming the opposite direction, and went,
That's why a lot of the racers talk about not going on the street. They don't.
Yeah, there's a huge responsibility, I think, that they're showing a huge respect for what they're capable of. It's the same way, you know, if you're a professional boxer, you'd never want to get into a street fight.
Right.
One, because you're going to get charged as using a lethal weapon or a deadly weapon on someone. And I don't think you could put a racer on a current street bike and send them through the mountains and not expect them to haul some ass. Because that's what their instincts and that's what they're trained to do. And, you know, they understand that, hey, you can't play like this. And this is not a game to be riding these motorcycles. And, you know, case in point is Craig Jones passed away earlier this week. And I know that other people in the racing community will feel that. And, you know, hopefully his passing will go beyond just the racing community.
I have to feel terrible for Andrew Pitt.
Yeah. Yeah, I've spoken with Andrew several times, and he's a nice guy. So.
Yeah, it's a sad moment. But let's go back to Laguna. So you obviously were in the garage. You guys have your own screens there. How much of the race do you actually get to see?
We see everything. We have the full feed that will then get distributed to either Eurosport or Speed Vision or whatever, and someone else will chop it up. But we have basically the main feed. We don't have access to every camera, obviously, but we have what's shown to all the teams. Then we have other additional timing screens that will show us each bike as they go through each section of the racetrack, you know, section one, section two, three, and four. So we really measure a lot of progress and evaluate the rider's performance through a racetrack based on those time splits, not just looking at the data that we download from the bike saying, oh, corner three and four are bad, but just, you know, you can basically say, okay, we're losing a lot of time in T3, section three, and we keep trying to work towards that. At the same time, you don't want to get tunnel vision and just go after one corner trying to improve through one corner. You want to improve through all the corners because that's where you'll make the majority of your time through the rest of the racetrack. It's a little bit about knowing your rider and what they're capable of and giving them the confidence to take it, you know, take themselves to a higher level with the bike.
One thing that was interesting when I was there, I got a chance to peek into the garage while Tony Ellis is watching the Rookies Cup race, and he was so incredibly
focused.
He was transfixed. Is that the way these guys
it's the way
watch
all
racing?
Of us watch races.
Yeah,
I can't watch races anymore. I'm sorry to say, I've kind of lost my fan perspective, and I don't watch a single bike go through a corner without analyzing what I see happening. I'm watching the suspension. I'm watching when the wrist moves. I'm watching how the bike bucks and reacts.
It's a lot like a musician listening to
a song he now knows
song.
How to play.
Yeah, they can't hear the entire song. They just hear the parts.
It's like that about all things, though. When you come to understand something, it might lose part of its magic because its mystery is a little bit has been revealed to you. I felt this way when I was playing a lot of guitar growing up and through college. You know, if I learned how to play something complex or I could mimic perfectly a Jimi Hendrix song, then I'd hear the song again and it's just not the same.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So I consciously had to step away from playing electric guitar at that point. You know, and it's not the same in that respect. Like, I don't want to step away from racing because it's not fun anymore. It's still fun, but now it's a more focused kind of fun. You know, now I have even clearer objectives and targets, you know, as far as what I want to see the rider do. And it goes just beyond performance. Now that I'm sort of in the back of the garage and I watch both teams, during the sessions, you know, qualifying or practice or the race, unless there's a problem with the bike or the track engineer, their chief mechanic, wants to make a change to the bike, I just stand there watching the feed, watching the times, watching the rider, watching the pit crews. I'll jump in, you know, when I see that there's a bunch of changes going on. If somebody needs a hand, I'll throw a wheel in or, you know, I'll assist. Just light stuff, because at the same time, you don't want to put something on the bike or do something to the bike, because each mechanic needs to be responsible for their actions and what they do. And if there is a problem with the bike on the track, if the bike comes back in after and the rider says, oh, this is a problem, or this bolt is loose, you know, the mechanic needs to say, okay, that was me. You know, so you don't want a lot of people jumping in there in that situation and getting their hands on everything. So in a way, I consciously stepped back. I know I could do more, obviously.
You guys are taking notes the whole time, I'm sure. Or are you just letting the computer do it?
What do you mean? As far as the changes we make?
Well, so you're watching the race, and if you see something that, like, oh, this is interesting, like this corner, we could probably do something with the suspension? Or is it? Are you waiting until the rider comes back and says...
We'll let the rider tell us. But if we see something in the data, we initiate the change. You know, oftentimes we tell the rider what we're changing and the reason why. A lot of it is you want to see basic stuff, like you don't want to see yourself topping out in the gears. You know, so obviously you check how the transmission's working and then you modify the transmission ratios. And sometimes you'll try different transmission ratios just because you want to see the rider, you know, go through a section in third gear rather than, you know, more strung out in second gear. So you'll do something close like that, and the rider will figure it out and go, okay, I like this way better. It feels smoother to me to use this gear than this, so I want this transmission in the bike, in both bikes. You know, and obviously you do the same thing with suspensions. The real limiting factor, I think, is time, you know, and time and comfort level with the track. Every time you go through a section, you're naturally going to pick up more things about that section or how the bike is reacting under you. So I think if we had more time to practice, we'd have faster lap times through qualifying and faster lap times through the race. But, you know, it seems like these days each session is different weather-wise.
Yeah, the whole
it's
year.
It's been
the whole
frustrating
year.
As hell.
It's amazing.
How you can have a wet session in the morning and a dry session in the afternoon and then the same thing the next day. And
Laguna was especially tricky.
Yeah, for Michelin
guys, my God.
Yeah, I don't want to point fingers because obviously...
Well, Colin already did, and so did Nikki.
Yeah, I mean...
Nikki was very upset about the fact that he said... before the race, bring softer tires, and they didn't.
Yeah, well, sometimes you win some, and sometimes you don't. It's part of the racing. I mean, it's all about the package, and obviously, no package is perfect every single time out the gate. We've seen mechanicals. Casey Stoner had a problem. Valentino's had a problem. Lorenzo has been his own problem at times. Pedrosa's had a crash. That was his problem.
Lorenzo, why do you think he's crashing so much?
Lorenzo is trying to realize his full potential.
He is realizing it. Hopefully, I mean, he had a fantastic start to the season. And do you think he just got too comfortable?
I don't know if comfortable is the right level, the right word. But you need a lot of confidence, and you need an ego to be a good racer. The same way you need an ego to be a good doctor, you know. And rather than talk about the racer right now, I'll talk a little bit about how I see certain people around my age. You know, I'm in my early 30s, so I've had friends that I've known, you know, from grade school that have gone through medical school now and have just studied for years, and maybe they're not as socially adept because they've spent so many years of their, you know, early adult life studying, or, you know, in the case of a law student, the same way, studying.
Incredible focus.
Yeah, and they're only around people with the same focus,
right.
And it's very competitive. You know, so you come out of school and your residency, and now you're supposed to be a doctor, and you're in your early 30s, and you need a little bit of an ego, because you don't want to second-guess yourself, and you don't want to say, well, it could be this, it could be that, I better double-check with this person and that. You know, maybe you do double check with somebody, but you don't tell the patient that.
Right.
You know, you always need to come off. Yeah, you always need to come off as knowing what you're doing. And a racer needs to be the same way. He needs to be clear about what he's experiencing and what he wants. And, you know, his support crew needs to be able to read him sometimes better than he can explain.
Right.
And sometimes... people just don't match. They're either oil and water, or, you know, for whatever reason, things don't gel. So obviously a team manager's job is to try and put people together that gel. And, you know, hopefully it all clicks. And some racers are smart enough, like Valentino, and they have the clout within the racing community to be able to say, no, my whole crew goes with me. I guess you'd never see that. I don't think any other rider could do that at this point.
Well, Dovi brought some people with him.
True, but those teams merged.
That's true, right, right.
Just a little background, Scott Colpron stepped up and absorbed part of the JIR team, Japan Internet, Italy Racing. So some of those guys moved out from JIR. I see them with some other teams, but a lot of them seem to be, have either gone home, or there's a few in 250. It is a really small world as far as how people move. And, you know, obviously changes are coming up in the 250 series. This is something I'm really watching closely as the four strokes come in.
Yeah, what do you think about that? What are your feelings?
My honest take? I don't like it.
We have 2 years left.
Yeah, but I like how special the 250 two-strokes are. You know, how close they are able to get in times for only being a quarter leader. I like how specialized they are. No one else races them. No one else really builds them except for 250 GP, one class. And look at the riders.
Those bikes are different than the
a Spanish version?
Well, the Spanish Championship, for example.
Well, they're always a higher step up. I think if you had the money and a manufacturer willing to give you those pieces, you could have that same bike in the Spanish Championship. But for the most part...
Because they're not purely prototype.
No, I wouldn't say purely prototype, but they really do push a lot of limits just for racing.
Yeah.
You know, when you see carbon fiber and aluminum and titanium reinforced swing arms, or you know, some of the suspension you just see on a 250 and the braking components, you go, wow, this is a purebred race bike. You're not going to see this kind of componentry on a street bike. They're not going to be tearing the motor down every night on a street bike.
Right.
Look at the riders that the 250 series has produced. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the 250
last few years, definitely.
Will always be, the 250 will be more of a hot rod than any 600 you can dream up. Just because of the lighter weight, the lighter mass of the engine, and the spinning centrifugal forces. I would have to say, if I took the top five 250 riders and the top five Formula Extreme or World Super Sport or any kind of 600 rider, I would lay money that the 250 riders would generally win in a head-to-head contest. I like the 250s. They're rocket ships.
Yeah, it's great racing.
Yeah.
Going back to riders, I noticed that Tony had a very interesting line through turn 11. He was really leaned over, much more than any other rider. He did not go across the apex.
Yeah, he didn't
out.
Square it off.
Yeah,
I've also heard different things about how our bikes sounded going into turn 11. And
different as opposed to like the factory team, or just in general?
Just in general. And each rider has a different style and a different line. You know, that's one way we've been able to improve a little bit lately with Sylvan, has been working on line selection. Part of it comes from growing up in the series and on these racetracks, and other times just each bike works differently. And I think that's part of Stoner's greatest abilities, is that he doesn't seem to be pigeonholed by a particular riding style. So in some corners you see him ride his bike like a 250, and other corners you see him ride it like a big bike, like a 990. He'll square the corner off and just power out. And he's able to switch his riding style based on the corner, whichever way is fastest through the corner. And you really have to watch, and if you're lucky, you'll see that stylistic change through different corners, and you'll see him try different styles through the corners in the beginning of the weekend. No.
Michelle.
You want to pause?
All right.
Yeah. Bio break?
Yeah. Bio break.
So, let's talk about, you wanted to talk about Ben Spies.
Ah, yes, the great white hope. Actually, that's James Toseland, but whatever. fascinating for me to watch an American rider come into the series on an arguably fairly fast bike. When I say fairly fast, with no disrespect, I'm going to paraphrase and use some of the Flamini brothers, or maybe it was who's the owner of the Alstair team right now? The boss of the Alstair team?
I don't know, sorry.
Whatever, I think it was that guy. And he told Ben the week before when he was checking out a World Superbike race, look, the Suzuki right now in MotoGP is an 8th place bike, and if you do better than 8th place, then you deserve to be in GP because you can outride the bike. If you do worse than 8th place, then maybe you belong in World Superbike. And I'll give you a factory Suzuki to race in World Superbike. Fonzie's bike.
Where's Fonzie going to go?
You know, and so that was what was offered to him the week before he got to Donington. Then we get to Donington and we have a dry day, and how unusual for England. But it was really nice to watch his crew kind of get used to him and watch how his early laps, how the bike was about a handful, and how they'd dial something in and he'd go back out for 5 laps, see his lap times change a little bit, come back in, and keep modifying back and forth to find a comfort level with the bike in the dry. And he really was smart about it. He didn't go out and try and set any lap records in his first couple laps. You know, he wasn't out to try and set the world on fire. It's like, okay, all of a sudden he's in the cockpit of a pure machine that's designed to do one thing, and he's got to learn how to use it to its potential. So he didn't go out there and try and force the bike into doing what he wanted. But just through his physical size, which is on the larger end for MotoGP, these bikes these days, you could really see him putting the muscle to it. Physically forcing the front end down, physically forcing it to change direction.
And it definitely looked very different on the bike than Vermeulen, for example.
Yeah. So I had a lot of fun studying.
Vermeulen's not a tiny guy either.
No. Chris is at least 5'10 and in fantastic physical condition. But yeah, watching Ben come to grips with the bike and learn the bike the first day was fascinating for me and for my engineers. You know, we all took time to study him whenever he was on the screens on TV. And kind of see what he was doing, and we could tell from the lap times that we'd probably be racing with him, which we ended up doing during the race. What we didn't account for was Saturday's wet qualifying, and for Ben to take a bike with a different brand of tire, a different level of tire, you know, and a different level of machine, and to go out in the wet and explore the levels of grip and control of the bike and get an 8th place qualifying position was amazing. That was really, really something. And, you know, I want to say that honestly, back in the days of the 500s, you could have a wild card rider that came in and had a new bike and had new tires, and maybe in the dry or maybe in the wet, they could have done a better qualifying position as a wild card. But now the bikes are so specialized and so focused, and the rider needs to be able to just trust completely in the system and the strategy at times, and then at other times he needs to really be the rider and do his job. I don't really see a wild card being able to come in the future and win a race, you know, whether or not it's at some place where they've got intimate track knowledge like Laguna Seca or anywhere in the world for that matter. You know,
how would you rate his Laguna Seca performance?
I expected a little more from him, considering he was on Bridgestones, and you know, it's...
He was about 15 seconds, no, more than that, behind Vermeulen.
Yeah, Vermeulen's always done really well at Laguna, and this was on World Superbikes, and Vermeulen's always done well there. But let's face it, Ben Spies has always done well at Laguna.
Yep.
Particularly against Mladen.
Yep.
And the parallel I made, because a lot of guys on my team would ask about him, because I'm American, so obviously I follow the series more than my Italians or Spaniards. And I would say, look, the honest truth is I think there are guys in GP that could not go head-to-head with Mladen week in and week out and beat him the way Ben Spies does. But at the same time, you know, I don't think Ben Spies could just come into MotoGP and immediately, you know, make a huge impact. Look at someone like Vermeulen. He came in on the 990 Honda.
Right.
You know, the bike was already developed. It worked well as a package. It had Michelin tires. He came in, and in his first race, he placed 12th. So I'd have to say that, you know, you want to look at statistics, Ben Spies had an average to good start in MotoGP. I think he's got a lot of potential, but whether or not he's going to be able to find the right package that suits his riding style and maybe his tires, you know, each guy will prefer a different kind of tire. You know, that will come to pass in the future. I don't know if he's going to come in next year or the year after or what his options are. Honestly, I don't know what his options are. But I think it was very classy that after Donington, when it became apparent that Caparossi wasn't going to ride in Assen, I think it was classy that they just said, okay, you know, we're going to park the bike. We don't need to get another rider on here just for Saturday and Sunday. Even if it is more track time for Ben, it's more of a respect thing, I think, to Laura saying, like, look, you tried, you rode the bike. We don't need the start grid money, right, you know, that badly, so we're not going to put a rider on here just to spin laps. You know, when Ben is going to ride the bike, it's going to be a full weekend with a full crew and not, you know, more of a last-ditch effort. So I think it was a classy thing for them to do. And even if it got less laps on the bike for Ben Spies, you know, he has the luxury of knowing, okay, the next time I'm going to ride the bike, it's all me. It's my bike. You know, my crew, well, the Japanese test crew. And it would be at a home track. And it was good. You know, I think he had a really strong showing towards the end of the race. He pushed away from packing at Laguna Seca, passed two guys, and I thought, oh, all right, he's going to be stronger through the last laps, and he's going to push his way up, and he did that. But, again, I've also read that he's going through some physical problems. You know, he was feeling sick that weekend, and maybe it was too much to race Superbike and the AMA and the GP bike.
Good, he had an appendix issue.
Maybe.
Oh, you had an operation?
Yeah. I got a haircut, too. They took off my hair. I still have the same head and the same problems. No, I only say that because I've also read somewhere online, so I can't confirm or deny. I honestly don't know. I don't have a lot of personal contact. Ben did kick my ass on some PlayStation 3 motocross game in England. Ugh.
Jamie Hacking.
Now that's a good start.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a guy that's been on different brands of bikes. He's been at it for a long time. You know, he was known as a crasher. He reined it in a little bit. He's got double championships in the AMA in the same year. He's really taming a wild beast in the Kawasaki and in the AMA right now. He gets on the GP bike, and he does great.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think his performance was better than Ben Spies. If I had to rate them side by side, I'd have to say that I think Hacking was at least as good, if not better, than Ben Spies at Laguna Seca, just because.
And Ben had an extra couple of
rides. Right, Ben had more. That's why. I think Hacking did an excellent job.
Yeah,
and
very impressive.
You know, I know he's in great shape. They train together. So the two of them, in my mind, are a little even. It'd be interesting to see what Hacking could do if he was on the third rock star Makita Yoshimura, whatever, Suzuki. You know, that would be something to see. But it's a question of growth potential. You know, you need a rider that's going to be able to adapt quickly to a new bike and a new track and maybe an evolution of parts, because the GP bikes change throughout the course of the season. They're not really based on anything except the formula that the factory thinks works. And you need a guy that's going to be able to grow. I think the most amazing growth potential we saw this year was Lorenzo coming in.
Yes.
You know, and slowly building up through the preseason and then hitting a home run and a slam dunk and a grand slam and all of it through the first four races. He was amazing. And I think he bit off more than he could chew, and it shook him up quite a bit. And I think his talent level is still there, but I think he's his own problem holding himself back. Because there's no reason why he still can't be doing as well as he started off doing. The Yamaha is still a good bike. Valentino's proving that the Yamaha is still working. Colin Edwards has been on the podium with Tech 3 more than once. So I don't think it's necessarily an issue with the bike or the tires. But that's what happens when you hit your head and break your feet and break your toes and your ankles and, you know, really get knocked around by your own doing. I would be really interested to hear what readers would write in or call in and say about the photos of the sequence where he crashed in China. because I've studied those photos extensively of his high side.
Yeah.
And I really want to know what they think that bike was doing. Because it's a really unusual looking crash to me.
Right, there's a challenge for you guys. Write in. What do you think?
Do it.
So you're going to go to Brno. What is your take on Brno? What's going to happen?
There's going to be a lot of bees. There always seem to be a lot of bees at that circuit. It's going to be pilsners and great Czech beer, but cheap. We'll be changing money into krones. Look for me in the Mandarin. And let's see.
Which of the remaining races are you looking forward to the most? For your team especially.
I think I'm definitely looking forward to a wet race. I don't care what racetrack it is, as long as it's raining hard, I think that'll be a good race for us.
Is Sylvain going to turn off the TC again?
No, you know, I don't know.
Was that for real?
Yeah. We had a problem with some sensors on the bike in the rain, and it created a condition where an alarm was set, you know, which signals the rider, hey, there could be a problem with this. And for peace of mind and just, you know, from his rider ability, he said, okay, if there is a potential problem with the traction control, I don't want it turning off in the middle of a corner or the middle of the race, so I'm just going to turn it off right now. And that was between lap 2 and 3. And then he proceeded to ride the rest of the race in the full wet condition without traction control on a rocket ship and brought it home in sixth. Yeah, brought it home in sixth.
Yeah.
So more than anything, that's been the highlight of the season so far. Another highlight was having my friends and good people around me at Laguna Seca, you know, come and visit the box. And
you're all smiles.
Yeah. I think that's the most relaxed race of the year, honestly, more than Valencia or any other race of the season, because it's the end of the 6 races. All the Europeans know they've got a vacation. Monterey's such a beautiful, relaxed place with good weather. It's a funky racetrack, so, you know, and it's away from a lot of the press and the media and the congestion and all the problems we get at European races. You don't have your semi-trucks there. None of your big sponsors show up in force with, you know, 10 people or 100 people. You know, so it's a lot more relaxed. There's not a lot of guests in the box. Boxes are a little small, the garages. But it's just a really relaxed race. Everybody finishes, you know, at night. They're like, oh, what do you want to do? Okay, let's go into Monterey or let's just relax. Or, you know, there's not a huge push to do something because, you know, you got to get the bike ready for the next race because you do have a break. So everybody seems to be all smiles. And the whole paddock just kind of feels that and realizes that.
Cool. So we will catch up with you in Indy.
Yeah, for sure.
We get to see you again in the States.
Yeah, it'll be definitely different. You know, all the Europeans say they love the U.S. and they love going to Laguna Seca. And I hope they feel the same way about Indy. I have my own reservations because at Indiana University, where I was at for a while, 45 miles south of Indianapolis, you know, I had my own experiences. And it'll be fun for the Europeans to see how different the country can be and still be the same country. Because I've been trying to warn them this for years, that, oh, it's really different in the middle. It's really different on the east. It's really different in the south. It's really different in Arizona. So it'll be kind of eye-opening for them. Looks like it's going to be a chain restaurant kind of week. I am disappointed. I took my monkey bike around Laguna Seca, and I took a scooter borrowed from Rockwall Honda around Laguna Seca, all in preparation for a track day I was going to do on Wednesday.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because if there's any week you want to do a track day at Laguna Seca, it's the week following the GP race and the AMA Superbike race when all the rubber is on the racetrack.
Right.
And you've been there working, and you've studied the racetrack, and you're fired up, and all you want to do is ride that racetrack. So you make plans, and you borrow someone's truck, and you arrange a bike, and you arrange your girlfriend to take time off of work so she can go with you, and you've got this huge, beautiful plan, and you pay for it, and you're ready to go, and the track day gets canceled. So that kind of was kind of a bummer.
Well, let's not end on a sad note.
But on the plus side, man, I put a lot of street miles on this Ducati, and it runs like a top. And you know, I haven't been on a current spec 600 this summer, but I can't say enough good things about the 848. I don't really care about the way it looks. It just works. And it's more bike than I can handle, more bike than I need. And I don't understand why people would even need a 1098 or a 1098R, not at this point.
Well, for the drag class sound.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, though. When you do pull the clutch in and out when you're at a stoplight, you actually do hear the clutch clocking away and okay, knocking right around inside the case. So, to me, it just sounds like a slightly goopy clutch. It's clock, 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 and then you pull the clutch lever in and the sound goes away. And it's fun. Fun bike.
Okay.
Thank you, Ducati North America, and thank you to everybody that's made this trip special and fun, and I'm glad I got to see everybody that I did at Laguna Seca, and here's hoping I see you at Indy, and maybe one of these days I'll start writing for my website again.
Yeah, that's right. We're missing those posts.
Well, my computer did break, and I did lose all my data from the last month from the hard drive because all my backup equipment's in Barcelona, so I'm now running a different machine, a different computer, and all my bookmarks are in Barcelona. I can't even access my website right now.
Oh, crap.
I'll say I'm pissed about the music and the photos I lost.
Well, we'll try to fix that.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, thank you, Liam.
No problem. Good to see you again, Jules.
All right. And now I'm going to run an interview that was recorded last Friday with Mark Neal, the director of Faster and other movies like The Doctor, The Tornado, and The Kentucky Kid. Again, apologies for the quality of this call. Apparently, Mark's son was practicing some guitar in the background. So we have an interesting soundtrack to this interview. It was over Skype, and there's a couple of places where Skype kind of busted out some noise on us. Just bear with us. I think you'll enjoy the interview.
Hi, we've got Mark Neal on Skype. Mark Neal is the director of the movie Faster and also a director of a film that I liked a lot, No Maps for These Territories, about William Gibson. And, of course, Dr. Tornado and Kentucky Kid.
Hi, yeah. No, I'm glad you're one of the people who've seen No Maps for These Territories. That's,
yeah.
It's always fun meeting people who've seen that.
I'm a big fan of his writing, so when it came out, I grabbed it. I actually didn't even realize that you were the same guy that directed that film until I did a little bit of research on you for the show, and I was like, oh my God, that's the same guy.
Right, yeah.
Right on.
Well, you know, that basically what happened was... I came to live in America 10 years ago, and at that time I was making most of my money doing music videos. But I had met William Gibson, you know, years before, and I loved his books. And I've ridden motorbikes, like, all my life, and loved bikes and motorcycle racing. And when, you know, things got really bad for the music video business in general, and obviously the whole music industry has changed and everything, you know, good things have come out of that because, you know, these days people like me can make independent films using digital technology and distribute them, you know, for not much money, which is something that I've done with all the films I've done. But at the same time, that whole wave of change obviously kind of wiped out the music industry. And so I found myself, like, not making music videos and thinking really hard about how to survive. And I decided that what I would try and do is make, you know, documentaries, because they're much cheaper to make than feature films. And I've done documentary work in television before, back in the UK.
Right.
And try and do them about subjects and people that I really admire or love. And so No Maps for These Territories, which is the film about William Gibson, and Faster might, like, seem really far apart to some people, but you're one of two people I've met who, like, ride motorbikes and are into, you know, love Gibson's books, and they're out there, you know? I mean, there's three of us, I guess, counting me, but I'm sure there's more. And that was kind of it for me. It was like, and I made that, and, you know, that was made, obviously, they're very, you know, I don't know what people think, but it didn't cost much to make it.
It sounds like your son started playing full on now.
Yeah, hang on a sec. Hey, Tommy! Sorry, yeah.
That's some serious guitar there.
Yeah, no, I guess it's the next documentary is about him and his friends.
There you go.
But it was that was the reason that I kind of started doing documentaries, and when I made the William Gibson one, it played lots of festivals, and it did really well critically, and it sort of kind of sold okay, and I've got distribution for it around the world now. But also, it was a real lesson in, like, you know, you need to find a really good subject with a bigger audience than William Gibson if you're going to make enough money to pay, you know, for the productions. I mean, not to make a lot of money, but just to pay for something like Faster.
Right.
You know, so that's why, I've met some people who, one guy in particular, a guy called Ian McLean, whose dad was one of the co-owners of the Red Bull Yamaha team in 2001. And it was through them, but they were people from the East Coast who didn't know me at all. I met Ian completely by chance, and it took like a couple of years of talking to him and his dad to kind of get a foot in the door. But that was kind of the plan. Is I thought, wow, if you could make a film about MotoGP independently, that's got a much bigger audience than William Gibson. You know, with all due respect to William Gibson. This was a much more commercial thing, but it was a documentary, and I could still do it independently. And that was always the thing for me. It's like, make films that other people are, where other people are not telling you what to do, and try and make them for people like yourself. Make them with kind of integrity and honesty, and make them as exciting and cool as you can.
You definitely achieved it with Faster, I think. Introduced a lot of people to the sport.
Yeah, well, I think that was the reason that we were able to get a deal with Dorna, which is the company that owns MotoGP, and which is a Spanish company. And the time we started talking to them back in 2000 was, you know, when they really turned their attention to trying to come to America. And obviously that didn't finally happen until 2005. But that way we're actually able to kind of strike a reasonable deal which didn't cost us an arm and a leg to make the film. And it was really great because, you know, if you made that film in England, you would do it differently because you know that loads of people know about it. But this way it was like a license to kind of just make it a kind of primer and an introduction to the sport, and it made the whole process of making it quite simple, because we just go up to whether it's Valentino Rossi or whoever and say, look, I just want to ask you kind of really basic questions, and I think they kind of like that as a change to people asking them really, you know, esoteric questions about the latest change to their Yamaha M1.
Right.
Just to say, you know, what did your mum think when you started doing this? It definitely kind of made it appeal to more people and people who didn't know about it. But I think it helped actually make it easier to talk to all those guys, just going in there like a kind of new guy who's just wants to find out as much as possible about how it all works. But what's cool is like that even in the UK, it's like it people really like it. And there's a long, long tradition there of, like, you know, I think the first world champions were British, you know,
right.
British and Italians. But, you know, but all the same, it seems to have gone down well kind of across all kinds of fan groups and non-fans. So, you know, that's I feel fortunate to have been able to do that.
Yeah, it's a very exciting film. And, you know, I know it introduced lots of friends of mine into the sport that I've been trying to get to watch a couple of races with me here and there, but it was difficult back then to even see GP racing. You know, Speed would show it, like, Speed TV here in the U.S. would show it, like, you know, on Tuesdays maybe, if you got lucky.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I've been following the sport since the late 80s. So it was great to for the movie to come out and be able to say, hey, look, especially when the DVD came out, you know, I bought copies for all my friends and just watch this and you'll get it, you know?
No, I love it when it's because there are quite a few people out there like you who I think have bought about 12 copies of it and given it to friends. And it's great. But no, and actually one of them was Wayne Rainey, who we gave him a lot of copies, of course, but he it was really great because he just said it's excellent because now I can just give people this and they understand what I did and you know why it was my life and it was funny. I mean, I guess these are people that he's known for quite a long time around Monterey and stuff, but you know, he said it's cool. This has allowed me to just, you know, turn people onto it without having to talk and talk and talk.
And how did you and McGregor get involved?
Through, just because I knew that he was into bikes. I didn't know him at all. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the things that I did to sell myself and the idea to Dorna and let me do it was to say that I would get Ewan McGregor. You know, they were, Dorna, you know, I suppose understandably, were always, you know, kind of very interested in having movie stars and rock stars involved because, you know, I worked with you too for a number of years. And I'm not joking, like right up until the very last shoot of Faster, the top guys at Dorna kept saying, so when is Bono coming to a race? And I genuinely tried to get him to come and he nearly came once. And I think that the in the end, you know, like they sort of weren't paying that much attention. It felt like all the time I was making Faster, they weren't paying much attention to that. And they were just obsessed with, like, which star are you going to bring to the race? Because they just thought I was, like, you know, access to these people. So I never told them I didn't know Ewan McGregor. And all through the production, I was trying to get a hold of him. And finally, and it literally was like 2 weeks before I had to finish the film because we were running out of time and we had to get it locked and finished. I got hold of him through a friend, literally through a friend of a friend. And he was filming the movie Big Fish down in Alabama. And so through this friend of a friend, I got a rough cut, you know, I sent a videotape to him by FedEx. And then I was kind of in despair at that point because I thought, you know, it's just not enough time left. And I thought I might hear back within a few days or whatever, or maybe a week. And literally, he must have got it and watched it because, you know, I know from the moment it was delivered, it was about 4 hours after the FedEx delivery that I came home and I found a message on the voicemail which sounded like Valentino Rossi. It was like this sort of this Italianish hype, you know, just saying this voice saying, "Mark, I like you very much. I like you. The film is very fast. I like you very much." And I thought, who on earth is this? And actually, I had just sent No Maps, the William Gibson film, to some European distributors, including some Italians. So I thought, well, maybe it's them. Maybe it's some Italians. And then the voice changed. He said, "Mark, it's Ewan McGregor, and I really like the film, and I want to do the narration." And, you know, 2 days later, down in, you know, Birmingham, Alabama, doing the, and that's the first time I met him.
Very good. How long did it take to do his part?
To do what?
To do the narration.
Oh, like 2 hours.
Wow.
You know, nothing. He, I mean, he's obviously, he's very good at what he does. And
how long did it take to make the whole film? Like, you were
to make the whole film? It took
2 years, right?
It took years. I mean, basically, we started filming in the middle of 2001, and we finished the film, you know, in April of 2003. So it took about 2 years of actual production time, but it took, you know, it took me a couple of years before that of a lot of meetings and talking to people, including, you know, Ian McLean and his Red Bull Yamaha team connections and Dorna. So, you know,
that between all those meetings over there, it's like a couple of years of preparation and development, and then 2 years to make it, and then another kind of couple of years spent, you know, spent trying to get it distributed and sold. And I was very involved in all of that. I mean, did you subscribe to the Faster website?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so I was the guy every day collecting the email addresses and making a long list of, you know, what turned into like 18,000 names.
Right.
And it was insane. It was, you know, it started with me sitting at the computer and writing, okay, this was what I would like to do, and then trying to raise the money and trying to get the, you know, whole thing rolling with Dorna. And then we made the film, and we did things that looked glamorous, like going to the Cannes Film Festival. And then it ended up with me back at the same computer just tapping away, typing names in for months. And then it just went on and on. It's still kind of going on in a way. But anyway, the hard work, I guess, was about serious hard work. Was like 3 years of making it and then trying to get it out there.
How'd you actually go about making the film? You used some footage, I think, for that Dorna gave you, right? But most of it was your own.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, what we did was, you know, like we figured out like we can use any Dorna stuff that we want. That was the deal with them, and that meant that we had about 10 years of archive material of theirs to kind of cherry pick for like really good moments and to help tell the stories of people like Kevin Schwantz and Wayne Rainey and Mick Doohan and so on. But the stuff that makes it look really good and all of the non-racing material is stuff that we shot ourselves. And, you know, we shot all the racing stuff that we shot with high-def, you know, big high-def cameras and with super 16mm film cameras. So on a big shoot, we'd have, you know, 10 cameras of our own, and then we'd try and get them to put onboard cameras where, you know, on the particular bikes or get particular bits and try and get them to put their cameras, to record stuff specially for us. But the stuff that gives it its look and feel is really the stuff that we shot.
Yeah.
But having said that, a lot of the great action is theirs because, you know, you only get that amount of good action stuff if you shoot with dozens of cameras for years and years, which is what they do.
Right.
But it was kind of, no, that was always the plan. It's like, wow, if I could only get my hands on what they do and then bring to it what we can do. And everyone was very skeptical about it, you know, like, you know, because I think to them it's like, you know, it's like anything. If you're in it and you do it every day, it doesn't seem that special. But to all of us outside of it, it's like we want to get in there and find out what goes on inside those teams and what those guys are like and what the riders are like and the mechanics and the truck drivers and all those people. I mean, I love doing all that stuff.
Oh, the truck driver interviews were fantastic. Such a good touch.
Yeah. No, like, you know that they know it all inside out, and they've got really great stories, and they're all. I think anybody who actually works in that world and holds down a job in it is pretty smart. They may not be very, you know, necessarily kind of highly educated, but there's a lot of really bright, smart people in there doing all kinds of different jobs, you know, and a lot of them are real characters. So it's very kind of rich territory.
Absolutely. I actually got to see the film when you were doing like a little tour in the U.S.
Yeah.
And you stopped in Sonoma here in California and
in
my country. And just there were probably about 50 or so people that rode in on bikes.
Yeah.
Went to some theater, and we were blown away.
Yeah, no, that's I wanted to go. I couldn't go to that one. I was in England. I think I was shooting some extra stuff for what became the second disc and the kind of sequel.
Right.
And that was part of a festival. It was fantastic, that festival. A friend of mine went instead, and he just said it was great because it was like, you know, really nice people and good food and wine and stuff, as well as the screenings. It sounded really good.
So what's next on your plate?
Well, the thing that I've been trying to do for years, and it, which started 5 years ago, is a feature film called, you know, the working title of it is Crasher, and it's a film set entirely in the world of MotoGP, or, you know, or the World Motorcycle Championships. But anyway, it's set in that world, you know, from beginning to end, and it stars Ewan McGregor as a rider who, a bit like Kevin Schwantz, he's kind of in his mid-30s and he hasn't yet won the world championship, although he kind of should have done. But he's, you know, he's had too many crashes and been too reckless, and so he's clearly, you know, drinking in the Last Chance Saloon, and he's got a year or so left if he's lucky and his body holds out and his team can stay together because they're running out of money. And so it kind of begins with him poised to maybe win the world championship. So it starts, you know, at the end of a season with the last race, and it follows a year, and it follows what happens to him and how that all connects with rivals that he has, and with a lot of kind of skullduggery and, you know, some seriously bad characters who are involved in the sport, but also some seriously good ones. And in the end, it kind of boils down to, you know, a sporting contest where you know he is a heroic figure, but it's in the context of a pretty dirty world, which you know I think everybody kind of knows how big sports work and how they're not really very fair, right. And there's a lot of rough stuff goes on. A lot of it's to do with power and money wielded.
Don't give away the ending.
Yeah, no, we won't. But it's kind of, you know, that's the journey that we go on. It's not just this guy trying to win the championship, but it's him and other people, you know, kind of working their way through this world where, you know, some serious bad, you know, not murderously bad, but just really nasty people get involved. And so there's a lot of fun and humor in it, as well as, you know, a lot of racing. So we're trying to do that. And
You're actually shooting it in the present, and you're going to be using real teams, yes. real personalities, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the parallel is John Frankenheimer's Grand Prix movie
from perfect.
You know, 1965.
Yeah,
where you know absolutely you shoot at real events, and you know we would do kind of what he did, which is, you know, you shoot the race, the real race, and then the day after the race, you kind of shoot your own sequences at the track. And obviously, you've got to design your shots so that you don't see empty stands and all that. But so we've got basically three fictional teams, and we're going to build those into the real world.
So are you going to like running special livery on the bikes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, totally. And but I mean, I don't mean that our bikes will be running in all the races for real. I mean, that our bikes will be shot. You know, you'll see them practicing, and you'll see them in the paddock and in the garages and everything. And that, but then when we include them in a race, it'll be because we've shot them kind of separately and put them in afterwards. So there won't be, you know, there won't be these three different teams mixing it up at every race all the way through the race. You know, it's got to be artfully put together, kind of partly there and partly afterwards. And you can do things like you can have the bikes sort of line up on a dummy grid, And then get out of the way before the real race starts and things like that. So you know, and that tells you that these you know, basically we've got three guys who are often at the front, and so in a race, you know, as in real races, like where you get Rossi and Stoner out the front at Laguna, you know, right. 10 seconds clear, you know, so you can do that. You know, you've got to do some shots where you see in the pack, and those are the tricky, kind of expensive ones that will involve some careful kind of planning. But you can shoot a lot of action stuff where you isolate your bikes and you don't have to worry about what's going on, you know, what would be further back. Although it's obviously very insulting to Valentino Rossi and Casey Stoner to think that they will be behind. But we'll kind of deal with that. I don't know when we'll shoot it.
Yeah. Are you actually going to all the different tracks? You're going all over the world?
No, I mean, we can't. But, I mean, you know, we shoot a lot of stuff here. I mean, so... but basically, yeah, we'll shoot at Laguna, we'll shoot at Indianapolis, and we'll shoot at, you know, three or four races elsewhere. It's very different because, you know, it involves, you know, large amounts of money and movie stars and fictitious stuff, and so it's not like Faster at all. We can't just kind of go around and shoot all over the place and and just collect stuff. You got to plan it all and do all that.
What stage is this movie in right now?
Well, it's a script. I mean, it's a fully finished script, and it's the script and me and Ewan McGregor and a producer and, you know, a couple of Hollywood agents talking to studios in Hollywood to see if we can get the money together. So,
is Dorno on board?
What? Ewan is completely on board. You know, I've written this thing.
I meant Dorna. Is Dorna on board with
this? Oh, sorry, Dorna. Yes. Yeah, Dorna is on board. I mean, excellent. They've read the script.
Excellent.
And they asked for one or two little changes, but nothing major. And so they are on board, yeah. I mean, I've been talking to them about it as well for 5 years, so.
Carmelo Espeleta has to be put in a good light.
What?
Carmelo Espeleta has to be in a good light.
Yeah, the guy in the movie, the guys who run the sport are not bad guys. I mean, in the sense that, but they're very like the real guys who run the sport, which is the, you know, they're interested in growing their sport, and they have quite a ruthless attitude to the teams and the riders because, you know,
it's a show.
They want riders who look good and do the PR stuff and in that sense I think they're pretty true to life, but they don't figure in any kind of prominent way in the story, but they are there, you know, and that mood of that pressure of like, you know, this is a show and you guys need to kind of put on a good show and show up for the interviews and stuff like that. So, which makes Ewan's character kind of a bit of a problem for them because he's really not interested in playing that game. He's in spirit, it belongs more to the kind of Eddie Lawson, Kevin Schwantz school of, you know, you say what you want and you do what you want kind of thing. Which is why we love him.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And this is like pretty much your first fictional work?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, you know, apart from music videos and bits and pieces of, you know, short films and things. Yeah. No, so as far as Hollywood's concerned, I'm an unknown first-time writer. And that's what makes it really hard to get this off the ground. But, you know, and that could happen. You know, I could be replaced easily. It might be that this thing ends up being made up by... It ends up being made, you know, and it's based on my script, but it's directed by, you know, Tony Scott or someone like that. I mean, those are all the things that you kind of have to be honest about with yourself, you know. But I'll try and make it if I can. But a lot is going to become clear in the next 2 or 3 months.
Oh, because
Ewan McGregor is living here now. What?
That's soon, huh?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've been, you know, it's been a lot of time of, like, you know, writing the script and talking to people and having meetings, you know, meetings with, like, agents and producers and people. And so a lot of that work's been done. And it's at the point now where we'll go and talk to the studios and pretty much they'll say yes or no. And one of the things they might say is, like, oh, yeah, we'd love to do this, but it has to be a big name director. Or maybe I can do it, you know. So, but I have to say, Ewan is being very loyal and is telling everyone that I have to direct it and that he thinks I can do it.
Excellent.
So, that's really, you know, obviously a key thing. Is,
well, I think to have somebody who's as much of a fan of the sport as you are is critical to for the, you know, the direction of the film.
Yeah. No. Exactly. Yeah, no, we've had some bad, you know, bad meetings with, you know, you do have these sessions with Hollywood people where you can see how horribly wrong it could go if if they did what they're talking about. You know, it's just, you know, it's that's why so many movies are bad. You know, these idiots just doing stupid things because they've got the power and the money to do what they want, kind of thing.
Right, right.
So,
and you also mentioned you're working on a documentary about Writers for Health.
Yeah, I've, like everyone, I've kind of known about them, you know, for a few years. I mean, like, I think everyone sort of in the sport, and a lot of the fans of the sport know about them, and just, you know, we've sort of tried to help them out in various ways, and I made a little short piece about Riders for Health, which is on the second disc of Faster, and right. And you know, I think that sort of helped them a bit to get some more support here. But in general, they obviously do tons of stuff, and all the things that they've been doing, I think, have kind of generated quite a lot of momentum for them here. There are a lot of people now, I think, who are looking to help Riders for Health in kind of, you know, real ways, in like fundraising and having events and everything in America. And that's all really, I think, sort of come over the last few years, and with the Grand Prix coming here and everything. And so one thing I've always wanted to do is, because it's such a great story, is make a film about how it all started and what they do. And the Sundance Institute and the Skoll Foundation, you know, Jeff Skoll, have started a film fund for a series of documentaries about what they call social entrepreneurs, which is, you know, which is exactly Writers for Health, for example. You know, people who are not governments, and they're non-profit organizations that are. And so I'm, you know, I've got to get this proposal into them to Sundance by next Friday, and that would raise some of the money that we need.
You're a very busy week, huh?
Yeah, it's that probably sounds stupid laughing like that. I am. I'm a bit punch drunk from. I've been working on that proposal for days now. And
will you be following the writers actually in Africa and India?
Yeah, that would be. I mean, the film would be. It would sort of it would be sort of three journeys woven together throughout, and so you'd be cutting from one to the other. And the first journey, and sort of the main journey, is the journey of a particular health, you know, worker. Like, so preferably, I think it'd be great if it was a woman who gets her training. And so she, for example, is a nurse who is trained to ride a motorbike so that she can go and take vaccines and just look after people and so on in remote areas. And so it might be somebody from, you know, Lesotho or Kenya who goes to the rider's main training center. The training center is in Zimbabwe, in Harare. And so she'll go there and get her training, and you'll learn through her training how they work there and meet, you know, the characters who were involved in that. But then you'll go with her back to her country, and you know, so the end of the film and various sequences during it would be following her. And I'm, you know, some of it would be really tough, and some of it, you know, will be quite joyful. And the end of the film would be, you know, on a positive note, her reaching, you know, family or people in need in a remote area and you know, helping deliver babies and vaccinate kids and look after old people and new mothers and things. So that would be one story. And then the other two stories are, you know, a journey with Andrea Coleman and Barry Coleman as they go around the world. They're always traveling, you know, trying to raise money. And they're going to places like the Davos Forum in Switzerland, where it's all like mega rich people and organizations trying to do what they do and get money and fund these operations. So it's traveling with them, and so you kind of get their story of how it started and what they do. And then the third journey is basically to the racetracks, where you know, Randy Mamola's obviously the guy who first started this back in it. But it's like, and then it's sort of showing how the sport is connected to Riders for Health, and how, you know, it's all about the motorcycle and people who ride bikes, whether they're racers or people in Africa, and it's about how it's all connected, and so that will kind of be it. Would you like to watch that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, I think it's such an incredible story.
It is.
And just, you know, the way that, you know, Randy Mamola, in the mid 80s, he like donated a lot of, you know, a big donation to Save the Children. And Princess Anne, who is the patron of Save the Children, heard about this donation from this crazy racer. And so she invited him to meet her. And so the racer went, you know, goes and meets the princess, and she says, you know, you ought to go to Africa and see where your money goes. And so he went to Africa with Andrea, who was his kind of PR manager at the time. But she was a professional racer in her time. She raced for 5 years, and with her husband Barry Coleman, who's a writer, and they went to Somalia, and one of the things that they saw was like this garage full of broken down motorcycles, and so it's like then they found out that, you know, people, organizations donate bikes and system, and so they were just the right people, because, oh, you know, we know how to fix bikes and we know how to, you know, put a team together and, you know, do all this kind of stuff, and so that's how it started. But with, you know, a motorbike racer and the Princess Royal and broken down motorbikes lying around in Africa.
Wow.
And now they operate in like 6 countries and help literally, you know, they help millions of people.
Right.
And it's brilliant. So
it is. Okay, Mark, anything else you want to tell us you're working on in the future?
No, I mean, that's sort of pretty much it. I mean, it's, you know, nice to talk to you.
Great. We'd love to check up with you in maybe a few months and see how the project's going, moving around.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, I feel very confident we can get the Riders for Health thing done, and we'll see about the Hollywood thing. That's there's a lot more snakes in there than there are in Africa, I think.
Well said. Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay, man. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, ciao.
Bye.
Okay, you made it to the end of the show. So let's do this little contest I hinted at earlier. We have 3 free downloads of the movie Faster by Mark Neal from iTunes. And they will go to whoever can answer this trivia question I'm about to spring on you. What you do is you send in your answer to contest141@motogpod.com. 141, like this, the number of the show. And we will, if there's more than 3 correct answers, we'll just toss those into a virtual hat and pull out 3 names, 3 winners. The question is, who is the most successful GP winner at the Brno circuit? And that's across all GP classes. But I'll make it a little easier, and I'll limit it to just the new circuit, so since 1987. So send in that answer to contest141@motogpod.com, and good luck. I'll say thanks to Liam Schubert and Mark Neal, and to you guys for downloading the show. Don't forget, MotoGP is back this weekend at Brno. In America, it's being shown on CBS at 2 p.m. And we're in the last run of the last races now, so let's hope the season turns out as exciting as Laguna Seca was. I think it's going to be hard to top, but I think we're going to see some very good racing. So until next week, take care. Thank you for listening, and ciao. Actually, hang on. Wait. We're not done yet. Just as I was finishing up the show, results from FP1 at Brno came in, so I'm just going to run through this really quick because they're very interesting. We have Valentino Rossi led the first session by about a 12 one-hundredths of a second, almost 13 one-hundredths of a second over Casey Stoner. And they were both over a second and a little bit more over third-placed Shinya Nakano. Fourth place was Alex De Angelis. Fifth, John Hopkins. Sixth, Chris Vermeulen. Seventh, Tony Elias. Eighth, Loris Caparossi. And ninth, our first Michelin rider, Colin Edwards. So Bridgestone once again showing very strongly at Brno. Not surprising. 10th, Marco Melandri, but already good to see him in 10th, but he's already like 2 seconds off the Rossi's pace. 11th, Sylvain Gontoli. 12th, Andrea Dovizioso. 13th, Lorenzo. 14th, Depunier. 15th, James Toseland, disappointing. 16th, Anthony West. And 17th, Danny Pedrosa. Danny Pedrosa is 3.5 seconds off pace right now. So obviously still something going on there with his hand that he injured at the Saxon Ring. So what's interesting is we talked earlier about, if Rossi does well in FP1, does that mean he's going to go with this electronics package that they are using that normally gets tested after the race? They're actually using it. They're testing it right now. This definitely puts a lot of pressure on Ducati and Stoner. But again, it's only FP1, and we've got these morning sessions don't really account for too much because the temperature changes are pretty dramatic during the day. We've noticed that in the last 2 years, it's really the afternoon sessions that are the most important. And you never know, Casey Stoner could be sandbagging a bit, but considering that these two guys are over a second faster right from the start, I think they're both going to be pushing really hard, and all that stuff that happened at Laguna Seca is going to make for some incredible racing. Okay, we're really done now. Once again, thank you for downloading the show. Take care. Ciao.
SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.